Please be seated.
Calling 22 AP 11D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Stephen Johnson. Could I please have your appearances? All right, the lineup I have is 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes on rebuttal. Proceed.
Morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Stacey Rosenzweig. I'm with Hauling & Kao in Milwaukee, and I have the privilege to speak here today on behalf of the respondent, appellant Stephen Johnson. Also with me are my colleagues Sherry Chevalier and Daniel O'Brien. We requested oral argument in this case because there are several items in friction with each other, several objectives, several interests in friction. Principally, that discipline is not a one-size-fits-all matter. It's not cookie-cutter, there's no flowchart, there's no checkbox. It needs to be individualized based on the facts and circumstances below. We're going to be focusing today primarily on the proposed sanction. OLR sought, and the referee has recommended a six-month suspension for Attorney Johnson, which we contend is overkill. Even in light of the changes to SCR 22.30, which allow reinstatement in some cases following a petition should the Office of Lawyer Regulation not object to the reinstatement. The purpose of professional discipline is not to punish. It's well settled, State versus Aldrich, among other cases. It's to rehabilitate the attorney. It's to protect the public. It's to deter similar conduct and also to impress on the attorney the seriousness of the conduct.
Can I just verify a couple of things at the outset? You said sanctions is where it's at today. That's what you're arguing. So the various clearly erroneous factual findings and the burden of proof questions that you raised are gone.
Well, it's not that they're gone, but we do offer them as context, and we understand that this is a high burden of the burden of proof, while it's the OLR's, on appeal for this court. The court accepts findings of fact unless they are clearly erroneous, and that is a very high bar. So while Attorney Johnson does fervently disagree with many of the findings, our focus today is on the proposed sanction. You indicated you had a couple of matters to clarify, Madam Chief.
There were three things. Clearly erroneous factual findings, OLR failed to meet its burden of proof, and that the six-month sanction is excessive. Now I hear you today saying you're really just arguing the sanction is excessive.
And we offer the discussion in our brief to set the context for the broader question of sanctions. And so where we do disagree with the findings, that should be taken in these totality of the individualized circumstances. But 6 months is an important distinction in attorney discipline because after 6 months, attorneys need to reapply via a petitioning process, whereas any sanction short of that, even 5 months, 28 days, it's an affidavit of compliance with the suspension. As Chief Justice Ziegler indicated in the dissent in the Robert Moody case of 2020, courts should say what they mean and mean what they say. And here, in all likelihood, if a six-month suspension is imposed, it's going to be longer than 6 months. The rule change does offer a little bit of potential relief from that. But as discipline is a lagging indicator, it lags rule changes, reinstatement is going to be a lagging indicator. And at this point, we don't know how that there haven't been that many cases. We're only able to locate a couple that are in the brief. We don't know how that's going to play out. But in all likelihood, Office of Lawyer Regulation, if this is a six-month suspension, is going to be the gatekeeper as to whether this is truly 6 months or becomes 18 months, 20 months, or more. We included on page 50 of our brief, of our initial brief, a recitation of several cases showing the time lag between the petition for reinstatement and actual reinstatement. And in several cases, it was close to a year or even longer. But regardless, to explain why this proposed sanction is excessive, we do offer some context for those five counts that were charged and ultimately found by the referee. And as a subset of that, I've divided them into three general areas of concern. Attorney Johnson's office behavior, the supervision and training of his staff, and then his conduct before those two court commissioners. And also to provide context, we need to remind the court that the events complained of here happened during some of the worst times in Attorney Johnson's life. We offer that for context, not for excuse. The first count charged was a violation of SCR 2040.05, the attorney's oath, that prohibits attorneys from engaging in offensive personality. That's enforced through the Supreme Court rule SCR 28.4G. And Attorney Johnson, at the hearing, did acknowledge some problems with his office behavior. But again, this happened in the context of some pretty bad times in his life. His former spouse, the mother of his young daughter, who'd been ill for many years, but with whom he'd enjoyed a very cooperative co-parenting relationship, shared custody, shared placement. She'd been ill for several years, but she took a turn and passed away, leaving him the grieving father of a grieving child. He still loved his former spouse very much. They were close, even if they couldn't be married. It took him a really long time to realize that this had affected him. Like many lawyers, he pretended things were okay. He assumed they were. He felt they were, but they weren't. And this tension did come out in the office. Some of the witnesses did acknowledge this. He acknowledged this. He used bad language. He was tense. And at one point, he did acknowledge using a racial slur to address a friend of his. He used it as a greeting, not as a slur. He didn't say it to a client or to describe somebody of the race in question. But he acknowledged that was still really inappropriate, wrong, and hurtful in an office setting or really anywhere else. He accepted the wrongful nature of that conduct. He does disagree at this point with some of the other findings, particularly with regard to how he treated his paralegals and things he might have said. But putting that aside, we understand the clearly erroneous standard, and we understand that sanctions are what we're here to discuss today. But we can see that even if the referee was correct on every single finding of fact, that there is evidence in the record to support this, this still doesn't justify 6 months, even in light of the other potential issues. We provided several cases. I don't want to call them comparable cases, but they're not. They involve cases involving significantly more egregious behavior and significantly less of a sanction. For instance, the Bruckner case. The Bruckner case is probably the most egregious of these, in which the attorney was found and convicted of 7 counts of possessing child pornography. And he was only suspended for 5 months, and although I don't know the outcome, he had the ability to return to practice based on an affidavit. He did not have to petition. This is not child pornography. Nothing that Attorney Johnson was accused of doing, nothing that the referee found comes close to that. N. Ray Kratz. Kratz was an elected district attorney in a position of power. He used that power to send sexually explicit texts and other communications to people in incredibly vulnerable positions, including victims of crimes he was prosecuting. He got a 4-month suspension. He did have some mitigation, but still, this is not that. This is not a sexual misconduct case. N. Ray Beaver. In this case involved an attorney who was involved in a dispute with his condominium association. I believe in our brief we may have misstated that the dispute leading to discipline was that it was an opposing lawyer. It was actually a fellow condo owner, so an opposing witness, and I apologize for that. But the basic facts, I think, are not the issue here. Attorney Beaver threatened this opposing witness, told him, I keep a gun by my bed and I'm going to blow your head off. He tried to run him down with his tractor. He got 90 days. This is not that. Attorney Johnson is also accused of improper supervision of his employees. And again, some context is helpful here. Attorney Johnson has been, and all times relevant, was a solo practitioner. And to his credit, he doesn't try to do it all himself. You know, we all know of solos who are lawyer, paralegal, legal assistant, receptionist, trust accountant, marketing director, and caterer for their firms. But Attorney Johnson has employed a small staff of paralegals and others to help him. One of the facts found, or one of the issues here, was that Attorney Johnson was not on site as often as he should have been and was not able to supervise his employees correctly. Now, again, this all took place at the late in 2019 and then into 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic occurred and most of us were working far away from our support staff. He's been accused of two violations of SCR 25.3 requiring those supervision and about requiring that sort of level of supervision. He had systems in place. There was testimony from both his witness, Elizabeth Zach, and from some of the complaining witnesses that there was training. But Attorney Johnson did some of this training, at least for some of the employees. And then a qualified paralegal, Fallon Williams, did some training as well. And that he maintained a thick binder, or he called it the paralegal binder, a Bible of checklists and forms and everything that the paralegals needed to do or that the support staff needed to do from A to Z. There was also testimony that he utilized electronic messaging, the Troop app and then the Slack app, to be notified of documents that were ready for filing. We concede this didn't always work, and that sometimes documents did get filed without his review. They were not supposed to be, but they did. Some of this may have been attributable to the rapid shift in how we practice based on the COVID-19 pandemic, where previously, particularly with criminal cases, he would be able to meet with his clients and sometimes hand the clerk documents. Not everything was e-filed at that point. So he would have reviewed them because they were physically in his hands, and his paralegals couldn't file them without him being able to handle them. This didn't work as well as it could have been. But again, even if we accept that the system didn't work, there is a difference between failing to have a system or ratifying conduct that you know isn't supposed to happen, like letting your paralegals meet with your clients or meet with or file things without them having been reviewed. There's a difference between having that system and having it fail and not having a system at all. And again, the case law on this point, we concede that you're supposed to keep these things, you're supposed to keep an eye on your paralegals. This is not a matter of a complete failure. This is a matter of degree. And the totality of the circumstances suggests that 6 months with all of this, again, is overkill. Another area to explore is Attorney Johnson's conduct with regard to two court cases, which I've kind of lumped together, but I'll try to address them separately. The first involved Fallon Williams. Ms. Williams was the paralegal in question. She'd worked with him on two different occasions and didn't have any trouble. The relevant here was that Ms. Williams' spouse was engaged in a family law matter involving his former partner or spouse. And there is some dispute in the record as to how this came about, but it doesn't really make a difference in the long run. There was a handwriting expert that was hired, and Attorney Johnson's office stamp was used to pay $1,500 for his services using an office check. Whether this was something Ms. Williams did on her own or that Attorney Johnson agreed should be a loan, that doesn't matter. That's a dispute, but it's not relevant to what we're here for. Attorney Johnson insisted it be paid back, and Fallon Williams agreed to pay it back. She agreed to pay $100, I don't recall whether it was a month or a paycheck, but she agreed to pay installments until it was paid off. She made two installments and then left employment. She quit. And then didn't pay anything else. Attorney Johnson couldn't collect it, so he exercised his right to the small claims process, filed a complaint for $1,300, and then he involved his colleague, Chad Fehrenkrug, and his colleague meaning a local attorney. They were not affiliated in a firm. Attorney Fehrenkrug was relatively inexperienced. Attorney Johnson wanted to help give him some experience, and frankly, he wasn't comfortable in small claims. He didn't have the time to deal with it, so he relied on his counsel to handle this. A default judgment was entered for that $1,300 as Ms. Williams didn't respond. But then a second bill appeared, this one for $2,887.90 from the handwriting expert. And at this point, Attorney Johnson realized that he'd been had. This wasn't anything that he'd agreed to. He didn't agree to pay anything beyond that $1,500, even as a loan. This was just a cost incurred. He's perceived this as a theft from him and his law firm. He went to the police. The police declined to get involved, but advised him to make a claim to his insurance and company, so he did. They filed suit. Actually, the lawsuit, excuse me, was filed a couple months ahead of the claim. The lawsuit was filed again in small claims court by attorney Fahrenkrug. He made an insurance claim, and those of us familiar with the insurance system might be surprised to find this out, but the claim was paid fairly quickly. Attorney Johnson notified Mr. Fahrenkrug of that fact. Again, when exactly that happened was in dispute, but it was no later than several days before a hearing in this matter, to let him know that that he'd been reimbursed. And at this point, the only thing on the table was attorney's fees, perhaps a deductible, but generally fees and costs. Now, Attorney Johnson testified in the hearing that he just didn't realize that this wasn't something you could get fees for, but he relied on Attorney Fahrenkrug to handle this. There was a hearing on October 6, 2020. At that point, the $1,300 default judgment had been entered in the first case, but the hearing was in the second case on the $2,800 and change. And again, we acknowledge that that hearing did not go as well as it should have. Attorney Johnson relied heavily on Mr. Fahrenkrug. This was a hearing that was conducted via an app called Pexip. It's a Zoom-like platform. If I refer to it as Zoom, that's what I'm talking about. But everybody was in separate places. And that's, I'm sorry, Your Honor? Okay. Everybody was in separate places. And Attorney Johnson expected Mr. Fahrenkrug to elicit this testimony about whether he'd been paid or not. He didn't. We acknowledge that Commissioner Budiak, who was conducting this, did have to pry it out of Attorney Johnson, and he regrets that. Again, this wasn't a matter of not doing it. It was a matter of degree. He did acknowledge, yeah, I've been paid at the same hearing, within the same context. And eventually the default judgment was vacated. He sent letters to the court on his own initiative, Attorney Johnson did, saying, I'm whole, we're done. The second matter involving a court commissioner involved a criminal defense matter, Dontell Petty. And here we do have a legal issue. There was a motion for summary judgment that was granted in Office of Lawyer Regulation's favor that we do believe it was improvidently granted. That was as to SCR 21.4, whether he communicated to his client the appropriateness or the effect of a waiver. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that Mr. Petty did not understand that waiver. And that's what SCR 21.4 requires. It requires communication about matters of the case that are in a way that the client can understand and with sufficient detail in the right language, et cetera. There's no evidence Mr. Petty did not understand the effect of the waiver. He wasn't called by OLR. He was never deposed. All we have is the transcript of that hearing in which the court commissioner, he asked, you know, Mr. Petty, have you reviewed this waiver with your attorney? And he said, well, with his paralegal. And at that point, it was pretty much cut off. This again was something that would have happened very differently had it happened a year earlier when court was in person. He would have been able to take a form, file it with the court, but he would have been able to have a conversation with his client in a conference room near the courthouse or failing that somewhere in the hallway prior to the conversation that he would have with the court commissioner. He was fully expecting that he would, if the court commissioner felt uncomfortable with the level of preparation or with the level of understanding Mr. Petty had, he was confident that he'd get sent into a breakout room to have this conversation based on past practice. That didn't happen. This hearing lasted for just a few minutes. It was shut down. It was adjourned. And at that point, the record is clear that Attorney Johnson did go over the matter with his client one more time. And at the adjourned hearing, the waiver was approved. So this isn't a case, I also need to add, this is a case in which no harm whatsoever came to this client. He was not in custody, so this didn't extend a pretrial detention any longer. He was a private pay client, he kept Attorney Johnson's services and concluded the case apparently to his satisfaction. Now OLR and I believe the referee talked about the potential for harm that people can be disciplined for the potential harm, but the case they offered was a case involving a lawyer who advertised that he could get his clients divorces in the Dominican Republic. And without acknowledging that they might not be honored in all states and that they may be stuck with things like bigamy or children, later born children having trouble with inheritances and things like that. But there was no, and there the potential for harm was discussed. There were 1,200 affected clients, and there are laws on bigamy and there are intestate succession laws and things like that. So the potential for harm, at least there, was something that could be quantified or something that was reasonably foreseeable. Here, there's no proof any harm occurred, and some vague potential that it could have occurred had things gone differently shouldn't be considered. The other count involving Dontell Petty did involve that waiver form itself, and Attorney Johnson again acknowledged his system failed. He used his paralegal did fill out the form. Mr. Petty acknowledged that he dropped into the, or the record shows that attorney, or that Mr. Petty walked into the office the Friday before this hearing without an appointment, talked to the paralegal. She pulled up a form. It was a state bar form that has form language. And then Attorney Johnson, whether it was approved for filing or not is perhaps unclear, but again, we acknowledge that that sometimes didn't go right, and Mr. Johnson would correct his people.
Counsel?
Yes.
As your yellow light is on and your time is waning, you started out by citing the some prior opinions.
Yes.
The DA who harassed the victim as he was prosecuting the husband in a domestic abuse case, as I recall, Kratz. 4 months. That was pretty horrible conduct. You talk next about, is it the Buchner case or something like that? Starts with a B. That's close enough. There, I think, maybe 5 months for child pornography, which, of course, under the statutes, oftentimes in terms of mandatory prison sentence for those felonies, it's a serious offense. I don't know how it all played out. So you give us some context, and then your argument has been discussing the counts, and I stop before you're totally finished with that, because I want you to get to the punchline of, I think you're arguing for 90 days.
That was what we asked for in our brief, yes, Your Honor, mm-hmm. And I'm sorry if I interrupted.
No, that's it. So Okay. Tell me why it's 90 days here, pulling it together, what you've given some prior cases in context. Another case you cited, it was, I think, physical altercation, lying to the police. That's a no-no, right?
And that was the Beaver case, and that was what we were anchoring ourselves to, I believe, that this ultimately the sanction is at the court's discretion with as informed by the referee and as informed by the arguments and of each side. Ultimately, it's up to you. We do ask for a sanction of somewhere less than 6 months because, as I stated earlier in my argument, 6 months is in all likelihood not going to be 6 months. It does seem here that there's almost a defense penalty. Attorney Johnson, in the referee report, Attorney Johnson was criticized for not taking responsibility or acknowledging wrongdoing. But that, again, talks to the tension that we're experiencing here between his right to defend himself, his right to put Office of Lawyer Regulation to its proof by that middle, clear, convincing, satisfactory evidence standard, and his ability to say that didn't happen at all. It would be a problem, you know, and maybe it would have been easier for him to just say, yeah, I'll admit to stuff I didn't do and throw myself at the mercy of the referee. But that's not, you know, that's not honest in itself. And that's not how this is supposed to work. While accepting responsibility can be a mitigating factor, it seems that this is being used to aggravate this sanction. And, you know, the cases that we were able to find where sanctions of 6 months or longer were imposed did have these aggravating factors. They may have had 20 counts of misconduct across 7 clients, typically involving things like trust account issues, failing to refund, failing to properly account. This involves office behavior during a horrible time in his life and some problems with his presentations to court, one of which when he was relying on another attorney to do.
Counsel, if we go with the 90 days, how do we know he's going to conform his conduct in the future?
Well, thank you, Justice Protasiewicz. We don't know anybody's going to conform their conduct in the future, but 90 days for a solo practitioner is a long time. He can't park his clients with a partner and come back like those of us in firms could if our firms would let us. He has to wind down. He has to notify courts. There's going to be reputational harm. There's reputational harm already. This has been publicized. This is something, you know, Attorney Johnson does take very seriously. And these are, you know, these have been very hard lessons for him going through this process. There are never any guarantees. I see my time is up. May I finish my thought?
Sentence.
Okay. There are never any guarantees, but the case law and the other, I don't want to call them comparables, just don't show that 6 months is appropriate.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. OLR asks that the court issue a decision which adopts the referee's findings of fact and conclusions of law that Attorney Johnson committed 5 counts of misconduct and which imposes a 6-month suspension of Attorney Johnson's law license as recommended by referee Bichelle. I was going to address 3 issues, but I'm going to address 2 issues now based on the concessions that I believe I heard earlier. I am going to be reviewing some of the referee's findings of fact for each of the counts in this case because the findings of fact as recited by counsel seems to reflect what Attorney Johnson had hoped the referee would find them to be. I'm going to review the key findings of fact as the referee actually found them to be because those facts, as found, really do dictate what the appropriate sanctions should be in this case. After reviewing those findings of fact, I am going to explain why a 6-month suspension is necessary to achieve the goals of attorney discipline in this case. With regard to the offensive personality conduct in count 1, the referee's findings of fact paint an ugly picture. Attorney Johnson repeatedly called staff derogatory and demeaning names. He used sexist terms. He used the N-word in the office in the presence of other non-lawyer staff. He frequently yelled at staff, often for extended periods of time. He banged his fist on the reception desk and on a wall in the office. He stated in the presence of multiple staff, quote, "I hope you and all of your effing children die," close quote. Johnson's conduct caused significant distress in the professional lives of his non-lawyer staff, and in the case of 2 of the staff, also affected their home lives as well. Johnson's behavior, in fact, was the reason that several of the staff quit employment with his office. With regard to count 2, the referee's key findings regarding that count, which related to the supervision and training of non-lawyer staff in the office, the referee describe what is somewhat of an alarming situation that was going on in Attorney Johnson's office. Non-lawyer staff were allowed to draft documents, affix Attorney Johnson's signature, and e-file them with the court. This was done with Johnson's knowledge and, for the most part, without his review of those documents. The documents that staff, non-lawyer staff, were filing included motions to continue, motions to substitute, and motions for modification of bond. Staff reviewed preliminary examination waiver forms with criminal defendant clients. They responded to questions from the clients. They also observed the clients sign those preliminary waiver forms in their presence and then filed them with the court. All of this was done without Attorney Johnson meeting with those clients. The same thing happened on multiple occasions with regard to plea questionnaires. Non-lawyer staff were meeting with clients and also answering questions. Staff drafted and sent demand letters to insurance companies in personal injury cases, again, without Attorney Johnson's review. Staff negotiated plea agreements directly with the district attorney's office using Attorney Johnson's email. The findings of fact regarding counts 1 and counts 2 have not been found to be clearly erroneous, and those facts as found by the referee should be the ones that the court is basing its decision on. With regard to the lack of candor with Commissioner Budiak in count 3, yes, Attorney Johnson did admit at some point in the October 6, 2020 hearing that he had been reimbursed for his claim damages. However, it was not until after his direct examination had concluded, after he had finished answering questions from Attorney Fehrenkrug, and after he had finished answering questions from Commissioner Budiak, that it was revealed by the defendant in the case that he had received reimbursement from his insurance company. So although he revealed it ultimately and admitted it ultimately, he shouldn't get credit for it because, again, it wasn't until someone called out his misstatement. Count 4 was a summary judgment decision in OLR's favor. The referee articulated three very, sound reasons for her determination. It's undisputed that Attorney Johnson did not meet with Mr. Petty to review the preliminary waiver form with him. It's not disputed that they appeared in this PEXIT hearing before the commissioner for the hearing on the preliminary examination waiver. One of the things that I do want to correct, I don't know if this is what counsel said or if I misheard it, but I believe she may have said that this was a state bar form that he used in his office. The waiver form was admitted in evidence. It's Exhibit 2 at the hearing. In your record index, it's number 39. That form was a form that had his information, Attorney Johnson's name, his address, his phone number, his bar number. This was his form. It was a pre-printed form. So to the extent that that may have been what counsel for Mr. Johnson said, I just want to make sure that it's clear. This wasn't a blank form like the ones that they leave on the desks or the tables in courtrooms for counsel and defendants to use. This was his form.
Did the language of the form comport with the standard pre-print form?
Yes, it did. And also admitted at hearing in this case was Exhibit 20, that standard form. I believe it was admitted. It may have just been judicial notice. But you can compare the two, and the language is almost identical. The The three reasons why the referee was correct to grant summary judgment in OLR's favor are that, first of all, Mr. Petty, the client, was waiving a statutory right to a preliminary examination. The definition of the practice of law includes giving advice or counsel to others as to their legal rights. He was waiving a legal right. Non-lawyer staff cannot review these types of forms with the client and their waiver be based on that. The task of explaining the waiver to Mr. Petty was one that could not be delegated to a non-lawyer staff member. The referee's statement that the client's decision to waive that statutory right had to be based on the attorney's explanation is a correct application of the rule to the facts in this case. Secondly, the referee correctly rejected Johnson's argument that in order to find a violation of the rule, OLR had to prove that Mr. Petty's decision was not informed. The referee pointed out that Johnson's argument focused only on the second half of the rule, and you have to read the rule as a whole. The client's decision has to be based on the attorney's explanation. And the third reason that she gave, which we had not, OLR had not argued in summary judgment briefing, but which I think was very compelling and logical, is that she described, and this is in the referee's decision, it's on pages 11 and 12, granting partial summary judgment. She described the colloquy from the Wisconsin jury instructions, which is recommended for when unrepresented defendants wish to waive their right to a preliminary examination. She notes that the substance of that colloquy would satisfy the mandate of 1.4B, that a matter be explained to the extent reasonably necessary to permit the client to make an informed decision. The substance of both that colloquy that she was citing in her decision and that in Attorney Johnson's waiver form were very similar, both of which refer to the purpose of a preliminary examination. They both refer to the fact that the defendant has a right to cross-examine the state's witnesses and to call witnesses on his own behalf, and that the court has the authority to dismiss the charges if probable cause is not established. The referee's experience as a circuit court judge led her to the correct conclusion of law and the correct application of this rule to the undisputed facts in the case. With regard to count five, it's not disputed that Johnson had not done any of the things that's represented in that waiver form. It's not disputed that it was a non-lawyer staff that actually met with Mr. Petty to review that waiver form. It's not disputed Johnson knew that this form had been filed with the court and indicated to the commissioner when the hearing started that they were ready to go. They were ready to proceed. The commissioner was not made aware of the false statement in the waiver form until it was the client that mentioned that he had reviewed this, but only with a paralegal at Attorney Johnson's office. Knowingly in the rules is defined as either actual knowledge of the fact in question or a person's knowledge can be inferred from circumstances. The referee concluded in this case that the circumstances established that Attorney Johnson was aware of what was in the form, making it a knowing misstatement, false statement to the commissioner. As to sanction, the OLR had recommended a 6-month suspension, and the referee additionally has recommended that in her referee report. There are 4 or 5 reasons why a 6-month suspension is needed in this case. The first reason is this individual, Attorney Johnson, violated a number of duties, professional duties. He violated his duty to his client, Mr. Petty, to explain a form to him. He violated his duty of candor to two tribunals. He violated his duty to non-lawyer staff to appropriately train and supervise them. And he violated his duty to uphold the oath that he took when he entered the profession. The factors that the referee considered and that the court should consider in determining the sanction level include the seriousness of Johnson's misconduct, impressing upon Johnson the seriousness of that misconduct, the need to protect the public, the courts, and the legal system from repetition of that misconduct, and deterring other attorneys from engaging in conduct similar to Johnson's. All of the violations are serious in this case.
Ms. Cluck, I want to make sure before your time's up that you respond to your friend on the other side and some of the points she's making and that Justice Anwash Bradley also spoke about was that there are some other cases that this court has decided where I think the argument is the conduct was worse, if you will, and those people received lower sanctions than what you are requesting here. Personally, I think this court has historically been way too easy on people who have engaged in acts of physical physical abuse, I'd say sexual harassment, I'd say sexual assault. I think I've had a hard time since I've been on the court wrapping my head around why we treat those who engage in financial crimes seemingly much harsher than those who commit crimes against, I'd say for the most part, women. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it, but that is the path that this court has gone down. It certainly is my hope that we will correct our course, in my opinion. But I am curious as to what your response is to the fact that we do have the sanction has been fewer months than 6 months and the conduct is seemingly grave.
Yes, thank you for the question. As the court is aware, all of these cases are unique, and that was something that the referee pointed out in her report and recommendation that the cases that we cited, somewhat helpful, but they're all unique, so not entirely helpful. In the Bruckner and Kratz case, that was a 5-month suspension and a 4-month suspension. Yes, it was serious conduct. It was a criminal act by Attorney Bruckner. And yes, Attorney Kratz's was serious conduct as well. I just want to point out that Attorney Kratz did not have any prior discipline, and I do not recall off the top of my head if Attorney Bruckner did. But that was serious conduct. In this case, we not only have serious conduct, we have someone who does not appear to appreciate the seriousness of the misconduct. There is a need to protect the public, the courts, and the legal system from a repetition of Johnson's misconduct. I think in Bruckner and Kratz, obviously we haven't seen a repetition, haven't been charged again. So that is a big factor in this case, in OLR's recommendation of a 6-month suspension. And another factor that the court should consider is deterring other attorneys from similar conduct to Attorney Johnson's. So, yes, it's very serious conduct. Based on all of the circumstances here, however, particularly the need to protect the courts, the public, and the legal system, a 6-month suspension is needed in order to make sure that there will not be a recurrence of this. And also, a 6-month suspension, as counsel pointed out, will require Attorney Johnson to petition for reinstatement. Requiring Attorney Johnson to petition for reinstatement is the only way to make sure that he has a proper understanding of and attitude towards the standards that are imposed upon members of the bar and will act in conformity with those standards. And that's because he will need to demonstrate that during the reinstatement process. In addition,
what's he going to need to demonstrate? That he no longer has offensive personality? I mean, what do we do?
I understand that he still contests the facts as they are, but he does not seem to appreciate the significance of the misconduct. He does not appear to have accepted responsibility for that misconduct. He blamed Commissioner Keberline for not allowing him to go have a private talk with his client as the reason that he didn't disclose that he hadn't reviewed the form with his client. He seemed to place responsibility on Attorney Fehrenkrug for not disclosing the insurance payment to the commissioner. He placed responsibility on Commissioner Budiak for apparently not asking the right questions in this case. The fact that he had non-lawyer staff essentially engaging in the practice of law indicates that he does not appreciate or understand the standards that apply or are imposed upon members of the bar. It is also the only way to, by making him go through the reinstatement process, that's also the only way that the court can be assured that he is someone who is fit to be consulted by others and to represent them and otherwise act in matters of trust and confidence, and in general to aid in the administration of justice. And that's because that is one of the factors that he will have to demonstrate in the reinstatement process.
And I just want to follow up on that earlier question. How is he going to go about demonstrating just that? You know, I mean, I think that was my question for counsel as well. How do we know that he's, you know, not going to reoffend? So you would maybe have a better idea. What does he have to do and what does he have to show in the reinstatement process?
He does have the burden of proof in the reinstatement process, and there are a number of things that factors that OLR and the court will look at to determine if he has met those. Whether he can demonstrate that and that actually reflect what his future behavior is, it may be two different things. He may know to say the right things during reinstatement. He may not. But without that reinstatement process, really it's difficult to know how you would protect the public, the courts, and the legal system from conduct where he has engaged in verbal abuse of staff, where he has allowed staff to engage in the practice of law. And who thinks it's appropriate or okay to make misstatements of fact to commissioners in two different proceedings? One other factor in this case is deterring other attorneys from similar conduct. A significant sanction is needed to deter other attorneys from conduct such as Attorney Johnson's. The referee noted that, quote, "I shudder to think," close quote, "of the number of criminal defendants that will be affected if Johnson's use of non-lawyer staff does not result in a significant sanction." The court's sanction of Attorney Johnson in this case has to convey to all Wisconsin attorneys that the conduct, all five counts of his misconduct in this case, will result in significant discipline. If there are no other questions, I'll just have one concluding statement. OLR asks the court to adopt the referee's findings of fact, conclusions of law, and impose that 6-month suspension. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob?
Thank you, Justices. I just have a few minutes of rebuttal here. We do note that in testimony and in our brief, Attorney Johnson agreed that if he were suspended or even if he was not suspended, if conditions were placed on his reinstatement or continued practice, he would be willing to abide by them. These could include counseling, monitoring, supervision, CLE, any combination. He'd be willing to do that, willing to report back to the OLR or whoever would be superintending this. He does understand that his law office practice does need some work. He's tried to improve on that process. Elizabeth Zach testified that supervision's in place. We understand she was remote, but she received the supervision she was supposed to have. Some of counsel's argument does speak to these contradictions. For instance, on the count pertaining to the criminal matter, in which counsel stated that the form was filed knowingly with incorrect information, but counsel also stated that Attorney Johnson had nothing to do with the form at all. So I don't know how we infer actual knowledge out of this. Either he didn't have anything to do with it and therefore didn't know what was in the form, or he did have something to, he did know about it and knew what was in the form. We can't have that both ways. We can't have both of those counts. And I do want to clarify, when I did discuss that this was a state form, a state bar form that was filed, I did mean this was a fillable form or a template form that was issued by the state bar that Attorney Johnson did pre-fill in his law firm name and all of that, because that would repeat on every use of his firm's, every time his firm used the form. But it was the state bar language, and that was what I meant in discussing that. Attorney Kluck did refer to no priors. Attorney Johnson's does have prior discipline. He acknowledges that. He takes responsibility for that. He has a public reprimand and a private reprimand from 2009 and 2010 for conduct a couple of years before that. The referee deemed those to be remote in time. We also note that Attorney Johnson got sober in 2013 and has maintained sobriety for over a decade. He's a different person now. He's a changed person as the result of his former spouse's illness, death, becoming the sole provider, the sole parent, the sole driver to school activities, the sole comforter at night of a girl who I believe was 12 at the time. You know, parenting a grieving child while you're grieving yourself has to be a particular brand of horrors, and it did affect his law practice. And it did, again, we offer this as for context, perhaps for mitigation, not for excuse. But things didn't go to the degree that he's accused of doing, but even if they did, this isn't child pornography. This isn't abusing your position as an elected DA for your own personal benefit. This isn't trying to physically harm and make death threats against somebody who's opposing you in a contested case. We ask that the court exercise, you know, its appropriate role with regard to the findings of fact. We will leave that to the court. But we do ask that the court not adopt the proposed sanction by the referee. We've asked for 90 days, but ultimately we ask that the court impose something short of something short of 6 months to allow the solo practitioner to take some time, right his ship, and be able to continue serving the Appleton area. And unless the court has any other questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your oral argument today. The court will convene in closed conference at 1:30.